Welcome to the Sacred Body Podcast. My name is Stacey Ramsauer, and I'm your host. This is an ongoing conversation about the sacred nature of embodiment and the path toward greater fulfillment as humans. We approach this conversation from the lens of birth, food, intimacy, sex, and much more. I hope you enjoy, and I'm so glad you're here. Welcome, everybody, to the Sacred Body Podcast. I'm thrilled this morning to have Sarah Bonds, one of my favorite people in the world, probably, but definitely one of my favorite people that I got to meet in Texas. And I'm grateful for the friendship that is blossoming and the relationship that came about from my finding out about the organization that Sarah founded, Circle of Health International. Circle of Health International is an aid agency and works to support women and babies in areas of crisis around the world. And Sarah founded that organization and is moving on to continue to create incredible organizations that stand for the well-being of humanity, is kind of a simple way of putting it. But I feel like
it's,
I think that you do, you are that. And it's one of those things that I keep learning. We don't often know the value that we bring to a room or a situation or an organization when it is so deeply our passion and our mission in life, just because we can't help ourselves but do this thing. And that's how I experience you and your work. I had the privilege to come to Austin and sit in the room with you and all the people involved with COHI, and it was just like, everyone in this room has to be doing this. There's nowhere else they'd rather be. There's like, for now, this is just what we're doing, and it's clear. So I'm thrilled to have you here, Sarah, and I would love for you to give your own intro that fills in all the gaps that I left about who you are.
I think you nailed the work part. Good job. I'm also a mom. I've got two sons. They are ages 9 and 11, which is a blast. Can I swear on this podcast?
Yes, you may.
It's a fucking blast. Their imaginations are so incredible. They're participatory in our household. They don't yet have screens in their hands, so they're present to what's going on. And it's just so fun. We're having, I feel like I have finally arrived as the parent that I wanted to be. I did not enjoy parenting babies. That was really hard for me. And toddlers was just so depleting.
Yeah.
But I love this phase. I'm really having a good time. I'm a wife married to a superhero of a man, a card-carrying feminist who also is a pediatrician and takes care of the sickest kids in the city. He's a really exceptional guy. I'm a Jew. I'm a Buddhist. I'm a fat middle-aged woman coming into her own and really kind of reveling in it. Oh, and I'm a Southerner. I'm from Arkansas and live in Texas.
All of these things I want to talk about. Because you live each of these elements of your life so fully and so well. And just starting with the fact, your willingness to acknowledge, I didn't love this part of mothering. This was really hard for me. This was depleting. I'm thrilled now. And what I know about you is how much a part of your mothering, your activism also is, because of how active your family is in what I'm just going to call social work, like being invested participants in your community and the global community as well. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, to start, deciding to be a parent is a political decision. So, you know, I very proudly had 3 abortions before I had 2 children and decided when and where, lucky enough to get to do all of those things in the way that I wanted to do them. Even when we had the first baby, we were living in the Middle East, and it was like, is this baby born in Israel? What are we, like, that's a really serious statement to make. We looked at birth centers in the West Bank. We thought about going to Egypt. We thought about going to Europe. Like, where are we going to have this baby? And then decided to have the baby with one of my dear, dear, dear friends who was a board member at COE at this beautiful birth center in the Nazareth in the Galilee, which was a pretty profound experience. Mm-hmm. So Naz was actually born. He's named after where he was born. He was born in one of the most blended cities in the world. He was born in a French-speaking Arab hospital on top of a hill in a Jewish country. And all of that was so intentional. Luckily enough, I found this guy willing to go, like, to live the level of intention and integrity that I am so deeply committed to in our lives, who takes all of this. He doesn't take it seriously. He's way playful and awesome. Thus, he's a pediatrician. I am, yeah, like, pretty serious and not playful. Although working on it. So together, you know, it comes quite naturally to us because it's who we are. Mm-hmm. He went to a medical school that focused on global health because that's the kind of healthcare provider he wants to be. It's just so embedded in who we are as humans that, of course, it would be who we are as a family. We've been doing more and more, you know, the kids are getting obviously bigger and more useful in service, yeah, situations. And that was hard for us at first. Like, we've been, you know, especially when it was just Naz, I just took him everywhere. He'd been to Gaza and all sorts of places by the time he was a year. But, you know, he was just a baby. He wasn't doing much. And he certainly wasn't there of his own free will. So, you know, we took him to places and we showed them things. I mean, we are on the regular at the Capitol. Like, Saturday, there was a rally here for Rodney Reed.
Yeah.
And my kids had had a very busy Saturday morning with soccer games and sleepover hangovers. And it was a beautiful day. And I said, hey, I'm going to this thing. This is what it is. Who wants to come? And one of them was like, I'm too tired. And the other one was like, okay, I'm coming. So we've gotten to a point in which they can choose.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not forcing them into the car like I used to, bribing them with trips to the ice cream store afterwards. They're becoming engaged citizens on their own. My 9-year-old just completed on his own volition, a week-long vegan challenge, which was very challenging for this household,
yeah,
because we don't have a lot of time to cook and meal plan and grocery shop. And we went even out to an event on election night, on Tuesday night, and there were not a lot of vegan things there. Thankfully, the cotton candy was vegan. But and the reason for that is because the climate matters a lot to him, the state of the world. Mm-hmm. He's pretty angry about it. He writes a lot of poetry about how the world is on fire and how people aren't doing enough. Mm-hmm. And so they're coming into their own. My oldest, my 11-year-old, is just such an empath. Last night he went over to help a friend cook dinner in the neighborhood, again, all on his own. Like, I just can't believe these little dudes and that they let me hang out with them. Mm-hmm. And they're so exemplary in their service to each other and to their community. And, you know, they are very honest. They are very on top of their pronouns and about how, if there is ever a thing when the older one gets to choose a thing, trans rights, we need to be beaten. And this is, I'm pretty sure, like a straight heteronormative kid.
Yeah.
But he has a friend at school who's trans, and he is just like, what can I do to make the world safer for him? Mm-hmm. So, you know, now I feel like I'm just in this sweet spot also where I'm just watching them do this on their own now in their own ways. Of course, you know, most of the social stuff that we do as a family has some sort of impact or service component to it. Although, let's be fair, like, I went to see Slater Kinney on Saturday night. There was no service component to that except for my heart.
Service of your joy and your pleasure.
Yes, which is, you know, as I have evolved as an activist, has become clear to me that that is really the secret ingredient to being able to do this in a sustained, yeah, way. And that's something we're also trying to teach them, is that, you know, as white men, you're at the top of the food pyramid, and you have a lot of responsibility in that. And also, this is a marathon, so don't burn out and don't dive in to an extent that you can't breathe and that you're not comfortable.
Yeah.
And by comfortable, I mean, like, supported.
Yeah, and it, you know, not bitter. Like, I think that's a real pitfall for activists. And what I kind of want to talk to you about is, while I'm certain there's an element, a vein of anger that's part of your activism, there is also a real feeling of love and camaraderie inherent in everything that it at least is created and actually put out there. Like, I don't know what's going on in the internal world of Sarah Bonds, but what I see you creating in the world, the wake that you leave, is togetherness. We're in this together. Let's do this together. It's not me against you. It's not us against them. Like, let's do this in a way that is, that can create more love at the end of it. And I wonder where that came from, if that's something you've, you know, is that something you've been consciously injecting into your work? Is that something that is a natural part of you, like your sister, as we were talking about before we started recording?
You know, it's interesting. I just wrote a piece for, it's called How I Killed Christmas. And that was the really angry iteration of me in my 20s, who was so self-righteous and so full of right and wrong. Like, I just really felt that this world was two buckets, right and wrong. And I was like the queen definer of that. And it was never subjective. It was always just sweatshops are bad. This is bad. This is good. This is bad. And, now I'm 45, and life has taught me a softer way. And, you know, I think I was really lonely being that angry, and I don't think I made much impact. And now I like to think I'm a kinder, gentler version of that. I'm certainly smarter, just by default. Another 20 years in me got me smarter. I think I also watched people around me, people in the feminist, fill in the blank, environmental, climate change, reproductive justice, whatever it is, there's a lot of toxicity there. And I had these assumptions around working for women in feminist-minded places and how that was going to be better than corporate America or working for men, and that isn't true. I've worked for some really great men. I've worked for some really shitty women. I've worked for some really shitty women and some really great women and some really shitty men. Like, it just, you know, they're good and bads wherever you look, and all of everything in between. But I really believe that in the feminist sector, if there's such a thing, there's a lot of toxicity and a lot of proving of ourselves. Sadly, we had a real tragedy in the humanitarian sector this week. One of our sisters in arms was murdered by her husband, and her daughter was murdered also. And this is a woman who has spent her life working against gender-based violence. And the community is really grieving, because this was very surprising and very sad, and it's a small community, so people who were close to her are really feeling the loss of it. It also reminds me that those of us who come to this work come to it to heal ourselves. When I was running the campus feminist organization in rural Montana, I was in a really abusive relationship. And I am not alone with that. You know, for folks who aren't familiar with second wave feminism, look up Betty Friedan, who was the founder of the National Organization for Women. Most of her press conference pictures, she's got on these like huge, very stylish sunglasses, because she always had black eyes and she did a lot of media. So this is real for us. It's tender. It's close to home. I have lived experience in violence and sexual assault. I was a heroin addict. I was homeless. Like, I have touched all of these things myself in my life. And I think that that is one of the reasons I feel, quite honestly, very responsible to do this work, in that I lived. I made it. I'm here. And if I was black, I would have been in jail in a heartbeat in my 20s for my behavior. And I'm just so lucky that I made it through that phase of my life. So, you know, I try to greet this work with empathy and gratitude, because I am just honestly so lucky to be here. I made it. through all of that. And as a white upper middle class person, I always had a safety net available to me. That safety net, sure, was laden with all sorts of other things that, you know, weren't perfect, but I always had an economically safe place to land, and that's no small thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm not angry at all anymore. I get really angry at my kids for, like, not putting the dishes away, and for when I hear or see them acting with entitlement, that really hurts my heart. But I am living a life beyond what I ever could have imagined for myself in regards to how loved I am and how safe I am, how inspired and supported. And there's just really no room for anger there for me. And I get that I get to have this experience because I'm white and upper middle class and straight and all of those things. And so in that, I try to really lead with generosity and inclusion. You know, the anger taught me a lot. It, like, was the fire that got me into rooms that I probably didn't deserve to be in, and that indignance and, like, oh, I can do this better than other people was how I learned a lot and made a lot of embarrassing errors. But I try not to have that be the fuel that fires me anymore.
One of your offerings out there is on your social media page, what is it, like, White People Wednesdays, like your weekly call out, which I love so much.
Yeah, I was calling it White People Wednesday, but then there were a lot of Jews that, because, you know, I'm Jewish.
And yeah.
There were a lot of Jews in that who, like, I don't know, the Jewish people, I won't even attempt to put all those people in a bucket. I got a lot of, my audience is upper middle class white people. That's who my people are. Mm-hmm. And the election of 2016 showed me that I was not doing a good job of bringing my people. And so that has been the work that I have been doing since then.
Yeah.
And so Reparations Wednesday, which is what I call it now.
Right.
But I lead with, hey, white people. And
yes.
White people over here. White people right here.
Hey, white people.
Hey, you need to do cash money in the hands of people of color. I try to use that platform for good. I find that kind of content from other people really useful and helpful in my own education. And so I'm just, you know, paying it back.
Well, someone that we have in common, I don't know her very well, but we did our Carriage House Birth doula training together, is Shishi Rose. And her, you know, black owned business kind of highlight in her stories. Mm-hmm. I really love that. And it's such a simple way. Like,
yeah.
I just feel really a real gratitude for you stepping forward, like, hey, white people, we're not doing a great job. And again, making this call in such a way that it's straightforward, and it allows me to work. You know, we have to have this conversation with each other. I had this conversation with my friend Davina on the podcast. It's not fair or appropriate to go to our black friends and say, how can I help? What can I do? We have to sit here in our discomfort and figure it out as people of privilege.
I mean, for God's sake, people, the internet.
Right. We have access to all the information.
Yeah, all the information.
It's all there. It's just where we choose to put our attention.
But, you know, I wonder if you're finding this. Like, I find that now that I'm like, all right, white people, stop being so fucking lazy. Use the shit for good. I am really noticing who in my network doesn't do that. Like, really simple things where people will be like, oh, I can't find the link for that. I'll be like, well, fucking Google it, bitch. Like, what am I, your oracle?
Yeah.
No. You know, like, we just bring this entitlement with us everywhere we go. And, you know, as a parent, that is one of the things I'm really trying to shut down at every turn. I mean, people who don't know me well are probably a little shocked to hear me say to my white kids, stop being so white and entitled, but that's what it is, you know? And, you know, they're learning from us and from the world, and I feel like maybe I wouldn't have been such an entitled asshole if somebody had taught me that a little earlier. I probably still would have been, and I'm sure I still am sometimes, but I just wish that this had been a conversation I had earlier in my life. My parents did a really good job. I mean, it was the 80s in rural Arkansas, you You know, I was raised by as radical as people that existed in that context. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of friends who died of AIDS in the early 80s, mm-hmm. and we lived in the college town, so there was more diversity there than in other states. And the college actually had a really good chemical engineering program, and so there were a lot of oil people there from all over the Middle East. And I remember my mom being really intentional about making friends with people from Kuwait and people from Qatar and people from Saudi Arabia. We had, you know, she just really tried in the ways as a single working mom getting her PhD with two, like, pretty entitled, well, I won't speak for my sister. My sister wasn't entitled. raising these kids pretty much on her own, you know, she did the best she could. And there, like, if there was an issue in our house, it was reproductive rights. She took us to Washington in 1992 to march on the Capitol, which was the biggest gathering at that point in time that had ever happened. Like, that was the issue in our house, that we were, that was our voting issue. And so she did a great job, and all of those were, you know, like, really instilling in us that we have a responsibility to take care of other people. And I think, much like myself and anyone who's a parent, what I did not foresee and what she did not foresee is that those chickens come home to roost. And what that means for my, like, very well-intended baby boomer mom is that now she's got these grandkids who are like, Nana, you know that you should give that homeless guy some money. And my mom will be like, no, we don't give homeless people money. Homeless people should get jobs. And my sons will be like, Nana, they have a job. That's their job. You don't judge. You give when people, I mean, they have been so indoctrinated, my children. But it's really fascinating to watch these two worlds not collide, because they love each other so much, but, and in that love for each other, like, if I had said that to my mom, whew, no way, right? But when she hears it from her grandchild, she's like, oh, aren't you sweet.
This grandchild thing is a really fascinating thing. I'm just entering the world of that, of, you know, I've seen my parents with grandchildren from my oldest brother, but now that I am also a boy mom like you, and that's something I'd love to talk to you about, feminists raising sons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have a sister, your mom was single for a lot of your life, so your experience of having boys, what was that like for you, and how has that been?
Oh my God, it was hilarious. I mean, it continues to be hilarious. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. I don't know that I would know what I'm doing if I had girls, but I definitely don't know what I'm, and I, like so many of us, was like, I'm gonna raise my kids in a gender free, no, whatever. They like ate their sandwiches into shapes of guns. Like, there was nothing I could do about it. And we had this, like, beautiful kickball fundraiser at the elementary school on Sunday. My children found, like, the two Nerf guns on campus, and were, like, running around shooting people with Nerf guns.
Yeah.
Boys, they're so loud. I think the level of noise was something I was totally unprepared for. How much they needed to be on my body all the time was crazy. I mean, I have this very visceral memory. So my kids are 19 months apart, which I do not recommend. I do also recommend, because it got it done and over with.
Yeah.
And now they are great friends and have each other in that way. So my husband was in his residency, which is to say he was never home, and when he was home, he was sleeping during their early childhood. So without really understanding that I was signing up for single parenthood of babies and toddlers, I absolutely was. A lot of resentment about that at the time. It's this one night, he's home, we're having sex. The baby starts crying. I get up. The baby and the toddler share a room. I get up. I go into the room. I nurse the baby. The toddler wakes up. I put the toddler back to sleep. Then I get back in bed. I finish having sex. And I just was like, my body is in service of men all fucking day long.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like if I had daughters, I would have felt differently about that. Like, the breastfeeding for me got really pretty tedious pretty quick.
Yeah.
And again, I don't know if it was because, like, having newborns was so exhausting to me. I don't know. I loved the intimacy of it, but I also was really pissed that, A, Adam couldn't do this, and why so much of this is my problem. Now, this is my problem, too.
Yeah.
And they were boys, and they needed my body. And that felt fucked up.
Hmm. What helped you process that, if anything?
Nothing. Mm-hmm. Nothing. And I nursed them both to a year. I did it. There are certainly moments of that that were glorious, and I wouldn't trade them for anything. And then there are moments when I'm like, why? Why did I do that when it was clearly so stressful and depleting for me?
Yeah.
I think the breast pump, in a way, has become a real weapon used against us. And in our, like, oh, well, that working mom, she was able to do all of that. So now if I can't, what does that say about me? I'm just one of those, like, I compare myself to everybody kind of person. So that was hard for me. Also, both babies nursed very differently. I didn't really make enough milk for the first one, but I didn't know that because I didn't have any other comparison yet. So he ate every 45 minutes for a year, and I, like, didn't know. I just thought that's what was normal. And then I got another baby who ate every 6 hours, and I was like, oh, this. I could do this for a long time. But also, I was the primary stay-at-home with the first one, and Adam was the primary stay-at-home for the next year. I went back to work. I was on my first airplane to Haiti when Bodhi was 6 weeks old.
Oh, wow.
And just needed, like, I needed my brain back.
Yeah.
I needed to be good at doing something I was good at, because I didn't feel I was good at being married. I didn't feel I was good at being a parent. And so my job really provided that until I got my marriage back and I got, and my kids grew up a little bit. And now I feel like I'm a real good parent. But,
I think that's so
hard.
That's something that has to be validated. It's like, you're not the first person I've heard say this. One of my other friends and teachers, Rochelle, she, you know, did not love being a baby mom. And now her daughter is 9 and she loves being a mother, and it's a whole different experience. And I think that just in general, the assumption that we make as birthing people is like, I have to love every second of this, otherwise I'm ungrateful or I'm bad at this.
Dude, especially when you're married to, like, a bodhisattva pediatrician.
Yeah, I can imagine that makes it harder, too.
I mean, he just loves them all the time.
Yeah.
And so I was just like, I'm a monster. This guy, he's, like, so chill. He's not getting any sleep. He's getting probably less sleep than I am. And when he's not here, he's, like, actually saving people's lives,
but
other children.
But the body element is a real big deal. The body element of having birthed and being the food source is fucking real. And I'm 2 months past birth, but, I'm really processing a lot. I think after you birth, you process it for the rest of your life. But I didn't love being pregnant. I didn't love not being able to do what I wanted with my body. And on the one hand, I think that's the fire we walk through to become parents. That's part of it. And it's, like, part of the transformation. And I also think that it's okay to not love it. It's okay to, I take a lot of power from having freedom in my body. It has always been the primary instrument of my self-expression and my work in the world. And there's not a lot of context for me to freely say that out loud. And, you know, with our partners, too, it's wonderful to have a partner, mine, who says, I wish I could do more. I wish I could do some of the feeding, but I can't. And that, it is a sacrifice. I'm just going to name it as that. It's a sacrifice to be the food source for your child with your body. And it is relentless. It's beautiful. It's miraculous. It's relentless. It is hard.
Yeah, it is all of those things.
And as you know, the people who birth, I imagine generally, it's like we're also, there just tends to be more of an association with birthing bodies being that much more vulnerable. And so to have your body be, like you said, at the service of another person is a lot.
It is. And thank
And there is a light at the end of the tunnel. Just like I have to, my reference point at this point is the actual labor that was so overwhelming. And it was 9 hours. Like, that's not long at all for a first-time mom. It's not long at all in general. And just,
You're taking plane rides that were longer than that.
Yeah, seriously. You can be in an airplane for longer than my labor lasted. I birthed a whole person in shorter time than it takes to fly to Australia.
Yep.
And like, to hold that, this is not forever. It's hard. And still to, you know, I think a huge part of healing is to acknowledge what's hard, what's uncomfortable, what we don't like, what's like all of the emotional junk stuff, substance, so that we can move on. Like, it does no good to try to, like, just move past it.
No, it really doesn't. And, you know, we're living the generational trauma of women who did that.
Right, exactly. Birth. We could talk about that all day. I'm curious about your impulse to study midwifery and how that specifically played a role in your activism and what you went on to create. And if it's not connected to how you made your way to the Middle East, I'd love to hear also about how you made your way to the Middle East.
So, you know, I don't tell this to a lot of people, but like, I had dreams about birth before I knew what birth was. I had this recurring dream that I was standing next to a small, shallow pool, and I was not my body. I was a different body, and this pool was outside, but it was like down, there was like a corridor. Excuse me. And in this dream, I would watch small bodies come into form and disappear from form. And I would also at the end of the hallway see a body appear and disappear. And to be fair, this band from the 90s Live has a song about this, so maybe it was just that it was the 90s and I was like subconscious and been influenced by this song, and so I was dreaming about it. But I associated that with to this thing that I was called to, and that was like a super teenage thing to do, right? Like, I'm that kid who was sure there was like a movie crew following me around because I was so important, right? And like, so I was gonna have I had a destiny. Know what it was, but it was going to be important and magnificent. And I think that, you know, this is anecdotal, but there is some history in my family on both sides of women in my families having been midwives, but also everybody was a midwife then. It was rural farming families. My mom's from a rural Mennonite community in North Dakota. Every woman helped women have babies. And my father is from a small community in rural Arkansas in the middle of the state called Van Buren County. Yes, it is the county that the Meth documentary on HBO is about.
Wow.
Those are the people. And so, you know, in rural America, whoever was there attended. Yeah. So I don't mean to say that I, like, come from a long tradition of deeply rooted medicine women or something like that. I come from rural people, and women helped women have babies.
Yeah.
And some of my women were those people. So, you know, it felt in me, like, in my body and in my mind and in my soul in a way that I didn't really understand as a young person. So, but I knew that it was something I wanted to do. I also did not go to college until I was in my late 20s. I was one of two kids from this very fancy, I mean, it was a public school, but I lived in a fancy town in Connecticut for a couple years. And only two of us didn't go to college. And I didn't go to college because I had gotten very sick. I got a thyroid disease right after I graduated from high school. And I had been on my way to what, you know, people were saying was going to be like an Olympic aiming career path as a swimmer. I had been a competitive swimmer for all of my childhood, loved it. It was my identity. And then that was gone. And so then I started doing drugs. And I did not do drugs, I don't think, because I was broken inside. I think I started doing drugs because I had this need to be high because as an athlete, I had been high. And that is what I was looking for. And so I just kept doing like more sort of radical drugs until I found heroin and I was like, yes, this is the thing I had been looking for. And luckily, lucky for me, that was short-lived and I didn't do too much damage to myself. But when I left that path and that part, that chapter of my life, the person that I then spent time with was a midwife. I detoxed from this heroin. I don't want to call it an addiction because it seems too easy to have stopped if it had actually been an addiction, and I've never felt the need to do it again. But I was hanging out in the desert in Sedona, and you know all about that place.
Yep.
And so I was lucky enough to fall into the hands of this midwife, and I'd never met a midwife before, and she was just so powerful and significant to be there with me at that point in my life that I was like, I want to do that thing.
Yeah.
And so also not understanding like how a person went about doing that. She was also a massage therapist. So I was like, oh, that's the first thing I do. Okay. So I'll go to massage school. So then I went to California and I went to massage school and that was fine and dandy. And then I moved to Oregon where I went to Birthing Way. I did graduate. That's where I went. And that's when I was like, I want this education, but I don't ever want to be a practicing midwife. I want this education because I want to be of service to women who have don't have access to other things, like the poorest of the women. I want to work with those women. So then I went to college in Montana and I got a women's studies degree. And while I was there, I went on a year abroad to India. So this really cool program for the University of Minnesota, where they had placements for all kinds of different things. And so they put me in a hospital in the middle of nowhere in northern India. And this hospital had just gotten a grant from UNICEF to train midwives. And I was like, I'm in. This is it. This is what I want to do. And so that project taught me a lot about international development and about the goods and the bads of that. Also taught me a lot about the kind of life that I was choosing and how remote and separate that would be from the family and the life that I have in America. And at that point I was like, sign me up, love it.
Yeah.
So went back to Montana, graduated, and then went to Boston University for my master's in public health. And my intention there was to actually dual major in both, get this dual concentration. One is my MPH, and then the other, they have a CNM program.
Oh, wow.
And I was going to do both. But I went to the orientation for the CNM program and everyone in the room was white. And I was like, nope, I'm out. And then I walked into the international health, so we call it there. Now we call it global health. But I walked into that orientation and was like, yes, people from all over the planet. It was a blast. I met my husband. I founded COE that year and then ran COE for 15 years. And it was amazing. But I didn't actually do much midwifery.
So you founded COE at the start of your grad program?
At the end.
Oh, at the end. Got it.
I had been offered my dream job, really, with this organization called World Vision, world's largest NGO, to run their maternal health product programs in northern Afghanistan, which has the highest maternal mortality rate in the world. I was yes, I was going to make a ton of money. I would have paid back all of my student debt. But I had just met this boy, and he was a boy, let me be clear. I was 30, he was 22. And my mom was like, what are you doing? And I was like, him.
All the time, I love him.
All the time, and it's wonderful. And I think I'm going to do this. Mm. And so my parents had just bought an Airstream trailer that was parked on the Colorado River in Austin, and they let me come and live in it and pay the bills. And that is where I founded COE. So I did that instead of going to Badakhshan, but also because I wanted a life with Adam that thankfully I got.
Amazing.
Yeah. So the Middle East, that was our first project. The board that I had at that point, the first board that COE had, they recommended that to start, we pick your audience won't see me doing this, but I'm using air quotes, a hard and a soft conflict. And the irony here is that our hard conflict was the West Bank and our soft conflict was Tibet. And it was so much easier to work in the West Bank, and it was so fucking hard and scary to work in Tibet. So the summer of 2004, which were our first projects, we got, I mean, we raised like, we did all of this on like $3,000. We went to the West Bank and did an assessment there. The wall was being constructed by Israel, between Israel and the West Bank. And there were some villages that were concerned about like what emergency services they need to make sure that they have when they wouldn't be able to access them anymore. So we were called in to do that assessment for them. And then we went from there to Tibet, where we designed a, we did a like very thorough needs assessment over the course of 10 weeks in rural Tibet, which is saying something, people. This is like the fucking surface of the moon. It is so far away from a civilization.
Wow.
And so then both of those programs scaled, and we were off to the races.
Amazing. And 15 years later,
you have 22 countries later, 3 million women later. I left that job in January, turned it over into very capable hands. Great board, Leah Little, who's serving as the interim CEO, is magical and so good. She has all of the skills I lacked, and she's doing a great job. And I am now free to do other things, which feels really good.
That's amazing. I mean, really the reach and the impact that Kohi had, I find so incredible. And I want to use the word impressive, but I, you know, there's like a pretentiousness that sort of comes along with that word, but really it's deep and it's on the ground and it's direct. Like, it's not only women working for the organization, but women to women, in that it's like the intention is so clear and direct, the intention to impact. And so anyone listening, I'm going to put all the details to Kohi so you can give them your dollars, because it's money well spent on the border with Mexico, doing care there for women and babies in Haiti. Is it still the only place where women can birth in Haiti? Like,
so,
like, center?
I don't know enough about what they're doing in Haiti to be able to speak to that.
Okay.
But when I, right, like what it looks like now.
Yeah.
But we were the last work that I was involved with there was with Midwives for Haiti, which is this really incredible organization training essentially like an army of Haitian midwives. And Haiti is a really hard place to have babies.
Mm-hmm.
And those women are really needed. I mean, I personally think the most impressive thing that Kohi is somehow still pulling off is its work in Syria.
Yeah.
Like, this is just like an impossible place to get to raise any money for. And I saw recently that they got another grant. I also know that the hospital that we've been supporting was bombed again. And I mean, that's just so, it's the last one.
Yeah.
And so now all of those physicians and nurses and scared families with newborns who need to be hooked up to machines and women who need C-sections are spread all over that part of the country. And they have some mobile clinics that they're working on. This is, I think, the third time the hospital's been bombed, but that is some really hard work to keep up. And it's hard work to keep exposing yourself to over and over and over again. And I mean, that was one of the reasons that I just needed to go. It's hard to walk into that every day. Obviously, it is a bazillion times harder to live it every day. I don't mean to to assert that those are the same thing. But this isn't my job, right? It's a job. And I am married to a man who goes to 1 to 2 baby funerals a month and also has a very hard job. And it just got to the point where we can't both have that job.
Yeah.
And Leah's great at it. So, you know, it's such a profound experience to get to lead an organization through that kind of work and to get to know the people and the partners on the ground. I will treasure that time always. And obviously I haven't stopped. I'm still going to the border like every 6 weeks. But it was just time for me to let somebody else do that and time to free up that mental and emotional space in my own life to do the different kind of work.
Yeah. Well, because you weren't just leading the organization, you were responsible for so many people. And as leader, you're the one kind of holding space for everyone's emotional experience of doing that work.
That part was really exhausting.
And being a mom and being a wife and being a person in the world.
Person in the world, trying.
A person in the world. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about the projects you're involved with now. And, you know, you and I had, unfortunately, I left Texas before we had the opportunity to collaborate in person, but I'm still holding out for something awesome down the line related to my favorite topic, which is sex and sexuality.
Always.
But you, that conversation that we had was so impactful for me because it was just one of the first times that I felt like just a clear conversation, a clear acknowledgement that if we are going to heal this severe sexual trauma that humans carry, it has to be a conversation that includes everyone. It has to be more about creating spaces that are safe for everyone and fostering the emotional maturity in everyone in order for sex to be safe and sane and pleasurable for everyone. Like, the reference point is not gender-based, it's not sexuality-based. The reference point is human. And everyone deserves to feel safe in their body and pleasure in their body. Those two things go hand in hand. So what is that looking like in your creative life right now? And how can we collaborate?
Well,
totally selfish question.
When I was leaving Circle of Health, we planned that exit to take 12 to 18 months. We were really thoughtful about it and had the luxury of doing that. So, you know, it wasn't dramatic or traumatic to the partners or the staff or anything. And so I had a lot of time to think about what did I love about this job and what do I want to bring with me? And so that fell into three buckets, if you will. One was the mentorship that I just love. I have loved the work I have been able to do to lift up other people doing this work. Like if there are people who want to start a nonprofit, please let me troubleshoot that with you so that I can save you years worth of money and mistakes. I love working with activists and advocates around privilege and prosperity because we spend our days asking for money and we need to get really clear on how to do that so that we have moved our own stuff out, and those of us we all have privileged work to do wherever you are on that spectrum. So those are sort of the frameworks of my coaching work that I'm doing, and it's just a blast. This year I've worked with folks in Europe, in the Middle East, all over the US. It's been really, really fun. And so that was one piece. The second piece was the activism. Like, I don't want to stop being an activist, but I gave up my platform, so now what do I do? And that was very hard for me this summer when there were all sorts of things happening and I didn't have a microphone anymore except myself. And I'm not that loud. So, you know, I've been trying to figure out what to do about that. So when I left Circle of Health, the board let me take this initiative called Activate Us with me, which is essentially an offering to people who don't fancy themselves activists but want to be doing something about the state of the world. And so we have rebranded that as a company called Waking Giants, and we just launched our first issue kit this last month on immigration, and we have a holiday survival kit, which is much lighter and more fun but very real for those of us who have folks in our families, chosen and otherwise, who don't agree with us on different issues and how to lead with connection and not conviction and really do some good self-care work going into the time you're going to spend around a table.
That sounds amazing.
So I'm loving that one. And then we will launch our full-on subscription service in January. The first issue will be the Second Amendment. So we have the kits, but then we're also doing these things we're calling Good Fight Delegations. And these are opportunities for people to engage in service that is not volunteerism. It is a lot of education and reflection and privilege and implicit bias work oriented around a service opportunity. So the first one will be on the border over Thanksgiving. And then the next one in January is going to be in Alabama at the Civil Rights Museum. Around the Second Amendment. So
wow.
So that is just a blast. And my co-founder, Martha Pinkoffs, is sent from heaven or wherever angels come from. And then the third thing I wanted to take with me was sex. Unfortunately, I have spent so much time in the last 20 years dealing with the bad fallout, like the sex people don't want to have, whether it's women being married off and not having access to family planning and finding themselves pregnant over and over again, whether it's sexual assault survivors, whether it's rape as a weapon of war and genocide survivors. That has been the majority of my work around sex. And that was really impacting, no surprise here, my sex life. And that was hard. It was really, really hard. And I don't want to stop working in sex and health and wellness in that way, and reproductive rights and reproductive justice. I want to flip it. I kind of just want to turn it inside out.
Yeah.
And so now I am spending a lot of time writing and talking and organizing around sex and pleasure and the science of pleasure as self-care. And also how essential it is that we start including men and boys in the conversation that we have with our daughters and our sisters and our mothers around sex. The 1970s and 1980s were incredible times for us in America as white women. There were good vibes and boys, babes in Toyland and all of these amazing retail opportunities that came up for us. But many of those didn't even allow men. And if a man came in, he was sort of ostracized and had to be under the protection of a woman. And what that has done is that it has equipped us with all of the tools that we need to be conscientious consumers of sex and participants in it. And it has crippled them. And they don't have what we have. And I have two sons and I have a husband, and I want them to have everything that I've had in regards to not just an informative retail experience, but a super awesome, fun, and playful one. I want them to have places on the internet where they know they can go to watch porn that didn't involve women getting hurt or children getting hurt. I want them to have availability to products that were designed for their bodies and for their brains, in a positive way, not an addictive way.
Right, and for their pleasure.
Pleasure as medicine. Mm. And so that's what I'm working on in that regard now.
So wonderful. It's such a, there's such a long road there. Yes. I feel like because you have had the opposite end of the spectrum experience, you bring that much more depth to the conversation around pleasure. Pleasure is medicine. And it doesn't, you know, I think we all want to be careful about including the acknowledgement that sex is not pleasurable for so many people. And there is so much fear around it and pain even. And our capacity for pleasure is first in that safety, the container of safety. I can talk about it. I can think about it. I can experiment. I can try things on. And also moving through, like creating a larger vocabulary for the times when it doesn't feel so good. And I'm not talking about like anyone withstanding abuse or a terrible situation. I'm saying that all of us, in order to, I think, heal this collective wound around sexuality, have to acknowledge that it doesn't always feel great. And the more we can build up our vocabulary around, I guess, consent, although that feels like a very specific thing nowadays. So I just want to say the language of asking for our needs to be met, the vocabulary required to be in consensual relationship all the time, everywhere with our bodies, that's such a huge piece. And we won't get that if we're not talking to each other, not just people who have shared experience, but the opposite experience, or, you know, kind of clearing the air around
I hear you.
You know what I'm saying? I'm kind of
totally.
Like,
I mean, one of the things that, as you know, I've spent the last 8 months really like spending a lot of time reading about sex, thinking about sex, listening to things about sex.
I hope having sex also.
It's great. It's so charged.
Yeah.
And that is such a bummer. Because it is this really wonderful thing that is actually, at its essence, pretty simple. But we have made it very complicated. And part of what I would love to do is to get to people to a spot where they can even be, I mean, people who have lived their lives, right? So like people like us who have a lived experience already, to be able to check in and tap in and get to that place where it's fun and connective and light and just be physical. It can just be this thing that happens in your body, like dancing or eating a good meal. Like, it doesn't have to be so heavy.
Mm-hmm.
I talk to a lot of parents about sex, and people my age, right, or yours, and how disappointing it is to me, the amount of people who are afraid to talk to their children about sex.
Yeah.
That just so bums me out, because I think that they smell your fear, your children, and they know it.
Yeah.
You know, like, they know the thing that you are afraid of, and then they're like, oh, shit, I need to be afraid, too. What is this thing I'm afraid of? I grew up in a house, for better or worse, where sex was not taboo, and any information I wanted about the mechanics of it were available to me. My mom didn't, she's a German, so it's like she generally doesn't present things with a lot of nuance. It's like, here's the thing. She comes out of the history, right? So, I think in regards to talking to kids about sex, that's exactly the approach.
Yep.
My when they were 6 and 8, they weren't asking about rape, you know, they weren't asking about consent. They were like, how's a baby happen again? You know, they don't need to know about the date rape you experienced. That's not what they're asking about.
Right.
They're just like, science, like mechanics, remind me, that's all they want. So just keep it there. You know, and obviously it's important to have like stranger danger conversation and those sorts of things. But I think it's equally important to, from the very beginning, call body parts by their names.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about how bodies feel good. And let them see you experiencing that in your own body. I think, you know, we can say all the things we want, but they, like us, are experiential learners and they will learn by watching. And when they see you struggling with this, they will in turn struggle with it. And just like, how incredible would it be if we could flip the switch on that one?
Yeah.
Let our generations be the last ones that had to come up in this world where sex was a power situation, where there was even like that it wasn't just assumed that of course there would be sharing and it would be an equitable experience and it would be about pleasure and fun and not about hurt or secrecy or shame,
yeah,
or getting away with something, you know? And that is, I'm just really trying hard with that on that one with my kids right now and the parents that I have access to, you know, like, why don't kids get vibrators when they have their bar mitzvah?
I was just gonna say bar mitzvah.
You know, like,
yeah.
why, who made these rules? Like, it happened a long time ago, and it was pretty provincial, and there wasn't an internet where they're going to get it anyway. So wouldn't you rather them get access to information from the people who know it and from a place that is respectful and rooted in kindness and joy? And, you know, that's really what the work that I want to do around sex now. And it certainly starts here. It starts at home. You know, my
yeah.
house is full of vibrators now because I started this retail experience that didn't go, but nonetheless, gave it a good shot. And my kids were making lube this summer.
That's
you know?
Amazing.
Like, we called it massage oil. They didn't know what it was like, you know, this isn't like child exploitation and I'm not having them check it in the bathroom and I'm not looking or something. But I think it's real. It's not like they don't know about this. So let's just
To that point, sex is something that is so innate and intuitive to start at its root, at its essence, that what you're describing is a way of providing healthy bumper rails for that development of something that is and must develop.
Yeah.
in the body.
And I get it that people are triggered by that. People have, you know, who've been hurt, you know,
for sure.
Who have some sort of sexual wound. Sorry.
That's okay.
About you. People are triggered by it, but their kids aren't. The kids are not triggered by it unless they also have had something unfortunate happen to them, and get them through it.
Yeah.
You know, get that child to an EMDR therapist immediately and get that shit out of their body so that they can get on with it.
Yeah. And where we kind of conclude here, I think is, I'm kind of assuming, but safely assuming, an agreement that the body is the epicenter of all of it. And the more there's so many tools at our disposal now, again, because of the internet, we have access to healing. We have access to sane conversations about this, processing our hurt, and communicating more effectively. I think even to include, our children in our healing process, in the sense that they see us cultivating pleasure in our body and working to overcome the hurt. You know, yeah, we do have a lot of work to do, but we have to start with ourselves.
Yeah, we do. And I hope that if there's anything that folks take away from listening to this little chat, is that, like, don't be afraid of the work. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you're going to be working all day anyway. Like, just work on the shit you want to work on and make it matter, you know, make it count for something. And I, you know, you and I were so privileged to have the careers that we have, doing the work that lifts us up and feeds us, and literally and metaphorically.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so cool to be living in a time and place where this is even possible. Like, this job didn't exist for my mom.
Totally. You know? Well, in honor of all those who came before us, who gave us this platform to live our life in joy and pleasure, I'm so honored to have spent this time with you, Sarah, and I'm going to include, I'll find out from you how you want me to give people access to you and the work that you're doing, particularly the mentorship and Raising Giants?
Waking
Giants. I'm into that myself. And I look forward to doing this again. We've got a lot more to talk about.
Well, welcome to motherhood. It agrees with you.
Thank you. Talk to you soon,
Thanks
Sarah.
Thanks for including me.
Thank you so much for joining us today on this episode of the Sacred Body Podcast. Please leave us a review if you have the time. Spread the word far and wide. Talk to you next time.